From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a hospital in Oregon when emergency room doctors diagnosed a 2-year-old girl with a serious and fast-growing bone infection. Simone Gorey needed surgery to save her leg, but her parents were unable to pay for the procedure. Their health insurance premiums had increased, and they couldn't afford coverage for Simone. A nurse realized the family might be eligible for the Children's Health Insurance Program, known as CHIP, and helped them fill out the application. Well, they were approved, and CHIP paid for most of the medical bills. Simone's mother, Erin Gorey, said, quote, "Without CHIP, we probably would have had to sell our house and declare bankruptcy." Well, the Goreys are among millions of American families that rely on CHIP to pay for their children's medical needs. The program was established 20 years ago, late 1997, under President Clinton, and passed with bipartisan support. Since then, it has remained essentially bipartisan. It has provided health insurance coverage for more than 9 million children and 370,000 pregnant women who make too much money to qualify for Medicaid but still live within the poverty level. Well, CHIP funding ended on September 30th, and Congress failed to reauthorize long-term appropriation for the program. A short-term spending bill will keep CHIP funded through March, but parents and healthcare providers are worried about the future of CHIP and the millions of children who are at risk if the funding ends. So this hour, we're going to answer your questions about what the program is, how it's seen locally, who benefits from it, and the kind of impact we can expect if CHIP were to actually end. I'd like to welcome our guests in studio. Dr. Elizabeth Murray is an assistant professor of pediatrics and a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital. Dr. Murray, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Steve Cook is an associate professor of pediatrics and a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital as well. Among many other things, we always shorten their titles. But Dr. Cook, thanks for being back here as well.
Thank you very much, Evan.
Well, let's just kind of start with the broad-based question on if you both of you view this as a serious possible issue or problem right now, because sometimes you hear about these debates in Congress and members of Congress will say, well, look, this is all overstated. We're going to figure this out. We're going to figure this out. But they haven't really figured it out. Dr. Murray, let's start with you. Do you see this as an actual threat to the program right now?
Yes, definitely.
That was easy.
All right, we're done. We can go.
You're not sitting here going, look, they're going to figure this out eventually. You don't trust that will definitely happen.
Well, figure it out and do what's right might not be the same thing. So I guess I'm pretty nervous that there may be a solution, but it might not necessarily be the solution that kids really need.
Okay, so what is the right thing, in other words, in your mind?
Well, you can look at it from a moral standpoint, you can look at an ethical standpoint, but I think it's better for us to even look at it from a standpoint of we know the cost of healthcare for adults when they do not get care as children. So a fiscally responsible standpoint, too. Making sure that we have kids who have access to preventative care and then emergency care when they need it. A healthy pediatric population makes an adult population that is healthy and strong as well. You know, if you look at the data coming out in the ACEs study, the adverse childhood experience data, and other similar things, we know, and there's hard, real evidence, that kids who do not get access to care, kids who have various experiences in their life, will go on and have very serious physical health consequences that are extremely expensive down the road. We can stop those from even happening. So we can save a lot of healthcare dollars in the future by keeping our kids healthy now.
I want us to talk more this hour about preventive care and whether the doctors in studio think that we have seen in recent years more emphasis on preventive care, because what Dr. Murray is saying is really borne out in study after study, the value of preventive care. But before we even get there, Dr. Murray, I've heard some members of Congress essentially say, look, this is like parents saying to a child who's in college, we're going to pay for your tuition bills. You're halfway through school. We just have to figure out how to do it. Maybe we'll sell a car or maybe we'll take out a loan. But either way, you're not dropping out of school. This is not going to happen. But you seem to be saying, you know, you don't necessarily trust that until you see the funding restored.
Correct. I want to see it.
Okay. Dr. Cook, what do you think?
I agree. This is something that's very threatening. Not every state is funded the same way. So even when we talk about the percentages, you know, what is the income level? It varies by state. It's how that state interprets it. And there are a number of states that ran out of funding that had to get emergency funds passed at the federal level and allocated so they could insure. New York didn't incur that, but if there wasn't an extension, we would have been running really close to it. But colleagues of mine in Colorado, Connecticut, other places are having to tell families that. And yes, we know prevention is exceedingly important. Not only will this benefit the child's immediate health, it'll benefit their future health. It'll benefit the family and the economy. I mean, parents won't be missing work to take care of a sick kid with a vaccine-preventable disease, or will hold off on a child with a chronic condition until waiting, you know, maybe it's worse now, and then take the kid in, and instead of a doctor's visit, it's a hospitalization. So, you know, and that's going to take parents out of the workforce. They're not going to be able to work. So the economic impact on this is just no one is really looking down the road too closely if they're playing around with this.
Let me go ahead and put my hand in the air and say I am the least expert person on certain issues that relate to insurance funding, et cetera. And I've done a lot of reading on CHIP, but I want to make sure we try to explain to our listeners as best we can who benefits. And as Dr. Cook just mentioned, it's different states are in different positions with this. So let's start there. My understanding, and this is a really shorthand, so please correct anything that you hear, this is not correct here, is that, you know, some states have, you know, kind of CHIP money in more in reserve than others. So when the current funding would run out, some states would have a little bit of a reserve fund to say, okay, we can carry through for 3 more months or 6 more months or 9 more months, and maybe they can get things figured out by then. And some states, at least 3 or 4, are essentially out already or staring right at it. I think Dr. Cook mentioned a few states that are in that position. So is that roughly correct, that the states are all in different kind of positions, but some might run out of funding earlier than others? Yes?
Yes, and there's different rules of engagement, too. So, I mean, I think first the low-hanging fruit here is, you know, unfortunately we hear people say, oh, we're not paying for immigrant kids. Well, this is only for American children. This is only for children of working parents. So this is working poor. So these are families that are going out, working, doing the best they can, but they're not either getting insurance through their employer or they're not qualifying for Medicaid. And then the rules of each state is different. So in New York State, it's based on 4 times the poverty level. South Carolina, it's set at 2 times the poverty level. And I think that's really important to realize what that number is. You know, so the federal poverty level for a family of four, I think, is $24,000.
$24,600.
So yep. Imagine trying to live with a family of four on $24,000. So New York State, it's set at 4 times the level. So that's, you know, what
just under $100,000.
It's, but right, then you know, think about all the things you have to pay for that whole family. So these are families that are out there working, doing what they can. So South Carolina, the rules are different there. So why is it a child, depending on where they live, they're going to have different access?
Okay, so can I just make sure we understand something here? So what I think what Dr. Murray is saying, correct me if I'm wrong here, is that in New York State, if you if you're working and earning just maybe $99,000 roughly or less, but not on Medicaid, you are eligible for CHIP.
If, depending on the size of your family.
A family of four.
Yes.
Family of four. You said four times poverty.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So if you lived in South Carolina, that same family would only be eligible if you're making $49,000 or less.
Correct.
Okay. So different state to state, not a lot of consistency there. So a family of four in New York State that's making $80,000 can get CHIP help. And if they move to South Carolina, all of a sudden they can't.
Correct.
Okay. Does that inconsistency bother you?
Yes. Why? I mean, if we want to take care of kids, if we want to take care of our population, why are we saying, well, we're only going to take care of some of the population? You guys who live in that other state are more important? No. You know, these children are already here. In my opinion, I think we have a moral and ethical responsibility to take care of these kids. I mean, not to be like Whitney Houston, the children of our future, but it's true. I mean, if we create an unhealthy population, we are going to be spending a lot more money, and we are not going to be the world leaders in science developments, inventions, all sorts of technology, all sorts of things, because we need a healthy, educated population to do all of these things to make our country great. And if everybody is sick and overweight and unable to function because they did not get good care as a child growing up and did not learn the things they need to do to be healthy and take care of themselves and then take care of their own family, we're just going to create this perpetual cycle.
Dr. Cook, how do you feel about that inconsistency state to state on standards for CHIP funding?
Well, I think it's obvious that if you have a child who has cystic fibrosis or cancer or even, you know, moderate asthma and they move from North Carolina, you know, move from New York to South Carolina, you know, all of a sudden, you know, chronic care management may not be covered. Parents are going to have to pay out of pocket for this. And again, these are families who these aren't families at the poverty level or below where Medicaid would kick in. These are usually working families. They may be, and they don't have employer-sponsored health insurance. So these are people who might be independent job owners or you know, work on their own or work for a small business. It doesn't really cover it. So, and this isn't insurance for the whole family. This is for the children and for pregnant women. So you're talking about really vulnerable population, people who can't get care. And you're talking about not just emergency room care, but hospitalizations, preventive visits, vision screening, development screening, dental care, prescription medications. And the fact that the states have worked with private payers to have these option plans, these Child Health Plus plans available that do have some rules. And that actually, if a family's at the higher end, excuse me, they may have a small deductible they're supposed to pay monthly.
All right. So what I want to do is tell our listeners here, as we talk about CHIP this hour, as we talk about the Child Health Insurance Program and what comes next and the benefits and the possible impacts here, if this cut in funding or if this sunset in funding is not restored, you can call the program. I'd love to hear from you, especially if you want to share anything about your own personal stories. I know sometimes that can be difficult, but sometimes people want to share their stories, especially as policy gets debated. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Dr. Murray, how often are you encountering, you know, patients, people who are in kids in your care where CHIP is in play?
A lot. The majority of the patients that I care for are either Medicaid or okay. CHIP, that they are getting some type of assistance.
Every day?
Oh, yes. Every day.
Yeah. Dr. Cook, every day?
Every day I'm seeing patients.
Okay. Every day you're seeing patients.
Yes.
Essentially
every day.
Every day
I'm seeing patients. Yes. Exactly right. And I think it's important to also mention the point that, you know, you hear a lot of hyperbolic rhetoric saying, oh, the sky is falling. Kids, you know, these people think, oh, their kids are going to get turned away. No, that's not true. You know, in the emergency department, we do not turn people away. People will have access to care, but the follow-up to that is their families are now going to be responsible for paying for it. So that's where the wrinkle comes in, is that, yes, kids will get care in emergencies. They can get perhaps they can get the surgeries, they can get the life-saving treatment they need. It's just now it's going to bankrupt their family. So you had a family that was self-sufficient, and now they are bankrupt. And that's where the problem lies.
Yeah, and so that's why we opened the program with that story out of Oregon, with a family saying that they literally were thinking about selling their house or declaring bankruptcy until CHIP stepped in to sort of cover that gap here. From the New York Times, I mean, there are so many different stories. Sonia Reynolds from Pleasant Grove, Utah, has 5 children on CHIP, including 2 with Crohn's disease, a chronic condition. Every 8 weeks, Sonia takes the 2 with Crohn's to a hospital for infusions of, is it Remicade, I think? Remicade, an expensive biologic drug. And without CHIP, she said, she could not afford those treatments. Amy Jo Hutchinson in Wheeling, West Virginia, has 2 daughters, ages 10 and 13. And as an infant, her older daughter was blind in one eye. CHIP helps pay for regular visits to a pediatric ophthalmologist. DeAndrea Choice of Tyler, Texas, said CHIP has been a blessing for her and her son. Her son's 15 now, regularly needs to visit medical specialists, and takes several medications for a condition known as fecal incontinence or encopresis. And without CHIP, she says, I would not have been able to afford his doctor visits, and his medicine would have been difficult for her to purchase. Those are just a few examples, and there are so many more that we could read throughout this hour. But let's hear from one of the more outspoken people in this. Interestingly, in the last year, one of the people who has been kind of leading some of the criticism in of what's going on in Washington has been a late night host. It's Jimmy Kimmel, who has a son who's had medical complications himself. This is him recently talking about the debate over funding with CHIP, which happened, by the way, to be going on right when the tax policy and tax bill was being debated and going through.
It's not controversial. It's not a partisan thing. In fact, the last time funding for CHIP was authorized was in 2015. It passed with a vote of 392 to 337 in the House and 92 to 8 in the Senate. Overwhelmingly, Democrats and Republicans supported it until now. Now CHIP has become a bargaining chip. It's on the back burner while they work out their new tax plans, which means parents of children with cancer and diabetes and heart problems are about to get letters saying their coverage could be cut off next month. Merry Christmas, right? So this happened because Congress, about 72 days ago, failed to approve funding for CHIP. Since the first time since it was created, 2 decades ago, this is literally a life and death program for American kids. It's always had bipartisan support, but this year they let the money for it expire while they work on getting tax cuts for their millionaire and billionaire donors. And imagine getting that letter, literally not knowing how you'll be able to afford to save your child's life. This is not a hypothetical. About 2 million CHIP kids have serious chronic conditions. I don't know about you. I've had enough of this. I don't know what could be more disgusting than putting a tax cut that mostly goes to rich people ahead of the lives of children. Why hasn't CHIP been funded already? If these were potato chips they were taking away from us, we would be marching on Washington with pitchforks and spears right now.
Right, that's Jimmy Kimmel. And what I want to do first is read the Washington Post fact check of what Jimmy Kimmel said about chip funding. And then we'll talk to our guests about it, because I think there's some interesting ways of looking at this. So let me quote from the Washington Post. Quote, support for chip does remain bipartisan. Kimmel starts to go off the rails by suggesting that support is no longer bipartisan. The federal fiscal year ended on September 30th, which is why funding technically ran out when chip was not reauthorized. But states may continue to spend unspent 2017 allotments and funds from earlier years. Three states and the District of Columbia were projected to exhaust their funds by the end of December. More than half the states would run out of funds if the fiscal year 2018 funding is not set by the end of March. That's the kind of deadline that focuses the attention of lawmakers. In any case, the stopgap spending bill approved in early December included a provision that permits the Department of Health and Human Services to shift funds internally to help states whose chip programs are running out of money. Kimmel falsely suggests that chip has become a bargaining chip as part of the negotiations over the tax plan. It's actually part of the usual year-end negotiations in Congress. Few lawmakers are really against chip. The question is how to fund it. House Republicans have complained that Democrats have not countered with their own funding proposals, while Democrats have said offsets should not be necessary when the tax bills will add to the federal budget deficit. They have instead pushed for a clean bill rather than one with poison pills. End quote. So I have to say, before I turn over to our guests there, I'm a little confused by the Washington Post fact check, because I didn't hear Jimmy Kimmel saying that that chip is directly related to the tax bill. I heard him basically saying that their priority was the tax bill, that there wasn't a lot of work behind the scenes in congressional halls to make sure we didn't get to this point with chip. And that when you see the priority being a tax bill, and that, you know, people have different opinions on the tax bill, but Kimmel is saying when you see that being the priority and chip is not reauthorized, then it does look like it's on the back burner, and that that's insulting, and that we should never get to that point. So I guess I was a little confused by that fact check, but the point that the Washington Post is making is there's no reason to think it's not bipartisan, that this is still very much likely to get reauthorized in some form, because it's always been bipartisan since it was created more than 20 years ago. Dr. Murray, what do you make of what you heard from Jimmy Kimmel and some of the fact check there?
Yeah, you know, this was the problem back in September when we were talking about this as well. It's kind of, you know, they have it. Everybody has always agreed on it. Let's just get it done. Why is it getting pushed down the road? It seems like it would be so easy if they all really are saying that they have a bipartisan plan, which all evidence is pointing to the fact that there is a bipartisan plan. So let's vote on it. Let's get it done. And then move on and talk about the other things. Instead, the reverse is happening. And so now things are getting pushed so far down the road that, you know, we have a stopgap measure in place now for another 2 weeks or so. But then we see states already running out of funding. You know, states who've been hit with hurricanes and other problems are having all sorts of funding difficulties because of the need to reallocate funds to cover CHIP or to cover other health crises because of hurricanes or natural disasters or things like that. So, yeah, exactly. It's where your priorities are. We are lucky to have a voice like Jimmy Kimmel speaking on behalf of this. He is certainly a very vested party in this because of what he's experienced with his son, and I think that's phenomenal that he's lending his voice. But I think we also have to make sure we're looking to all of the other leaders in the country, our politicians, our doctors who are living in, and other sources to make sure we understand the facts of it too, not just only depending on a celebrity, though the fact that he's brought such light to this, I think, is great.
Okay, Dr. Cook.
I think a couple of the important things to know is, yes, it does have bipartisan support. It's really important to understand that, I mean, it has overwhelming bipartisan support. When you look at those voting patterns, there's not many things in our government in the past 20, 30 years that get that support. And not only does it have that voting support, it's the funding duration. I mean, when CHIP was first approved and extended, it was put at 10 years, not 2 years or 4 years, that's going to impact someone's voting cycle and their election term. It was 10 years. So now they're actually talking about making it only 5 years. And they're talking about reducing some of the increments of the increases in future years and where the funding's coming from. They're proposing taking funds from separate allocated funding of a prevention fund, a federal prevention fund that was created through the Affordable Care Act. And so it's one of those opportunities to damage the Affordable Care Act, take money from that to pay for this in order to get their way. So it is politics, and it's really disgusting because the evidence for the benefit of this is you know, really strong and overwhelming. And I don't think we can, you know, sit back and just assume that the House version or the Senate version is going to be fine. We really have to talk to our elected officials and make sure they're doing the right things.
Okay. And so I think I also want to kind of clarify on the funding part of this. As Dr. Cook said, that's getting less attention. There's a lot more headlines about, is CHIP going to be reauthorized or not, or it hasn't been reauthorized yet, what happens in certain states to certain families. But if there isn't that commitment, of a long-term commitment of 5 years instead of 10, or if it's where does the money come from, that certainly feels like, I mean, what we've seen historically is that's going to make this much more of a political debate long-term, as opposed to saying this is set in stone, this is exactly how the formula works, and we're not going to deviate. In other words, this money is going to be there no matter what every year. We can debate other things. We can debate tax bills. We can debate funding priorities, but CHIP will be there. I don't think I see right now that that's definite, right, Dr. Murray?
I agree. I think if that statement was there, I think we'd all feel a lot better. I mean, it's just like financial planners, they always say, pay yourself first, right, and then do everything else. I mean, CHIP and care for the kids should be in that same realm of we're going to pay for our kids first and get that all done, and then we can distribute funds elsewhere.
Okay. And before we move on to some other issues here, I also want to just ask about politicization here, because that's been the allegation, especially from conservatives who say this is going to get funded. Is this politicized if, in fact, no families lose any sort of coverage? Or Dr. Cook, Dr. Murray, are you already hearing in other states that families are sort of being warned? I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, if no family truly gets impacted, if they figure this out eventually and everyone's fine, then maybe it's politicized. But if you're already telling families in certain states, get ready or you may incur these bills, that is a traumatic thing. I mean, I'm someone in my family who had a situation a number of years ago with a total of 12 inches, 12, not 12 feet, 12 inches off one step to another, and broke a leg so badly a doctor's considered amputation. It was on an icy day. And because of a paperwork snafu, was handed bills of tens of thousands of dollars and said to me, well, this is it for me. I don't know what's going to happen in my life. And then paperwork got cleared up. But there was about 48 hours where he felt traumatized by this. So what's currently happening that you're aware of, and should we at least be concerned that families are being warned about this, and that even that warning can be very, very difficult for families?
Well, I think, you know, in New York, having talked to some of our government affairs people and looking at locally what we're doing in New York, we feel assured that we're okay through this stopgap. But prior to this stopgap being voted, it wasn't clear what was going to happen. And then I had learned, you know, the stopgap was coming through. But I had a colleague who had mentioned a family asked them about it because they were on CHIP, and they were a suburban working family, but, you know, they have two independent jobs. They don't have health insurance through their employer. They're paying out of pocket. What are they going to have to do? So, and this is in New York where we actually have it covered, and we felt we would be able to ride out through the extension, and we probably will get the extension. So in other states where that's not the case, you know, people are getting hit with bills, you know, and what a great time of the year to do it, you know, right around Christmas, just what people need to experience.
Mm. Also, flu season, tons of viruses, tons of stuff going on. Yes, people are getting letters in other states, and families are not sure how to respond to them. But the natural kind of tendency is, well, if maybe I can just sit on this rash a little bit longer, maybe my child with a fever, I can wait on that. And maybe you can. But why gamble? Why gamble if yesterday you had the insurance and you had the coverage to do what you needed? Why is it the next day that you can't do what you need to do for your child?
Based on research done by the Johns Hopkins Children's Center, children without insurance have a 60% increased mortality rate in hospitals, and about 2 million CHIP enrollees have one of six chronic health conditions: asthma, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, diabetes, epilepsy, mood disorders, and developmental disorders such as autism. Consistent with what you see here, Dr. Murray?
Sure. I mean, all of those diseases, unfortunately, are becoming far more prevalent in our pediatric population. The ones that historically were thought of as adult diseases, diabetes, high blood pressure, we're seeing those in kids, young kids now.
You too, Dr. Cook.
Yeah, it's really concerning because We're doing a better job identifying these conditions, trying to treat them, but now we're actually pulling the rug out from under people. And we know that when we screen early and identify these issues early, we can actually benefit them sooner. There can be less of an impact of these conditions on people, and all that gets pushed away. So you don't screen and identify a problem before it's occurring. You're treating it after it's already taken effect, as opposed to when a child's three, you don't identify this learning problem until they're six and in school and behind a year.
So related to CHIP, but not just related to CHIP. Let me ask both of you, as pediatricians and as doctors who have been working in this field long before this administration and for a number of years, are you seeing more emphasis on preventive care in the last decade, in the last 5 years? And is that changing this year in any way? Dr. Murray?
I think it's more emphasis and guidelines and stuff for the doctors. I don't know that that's trickling down to the average families recognizing the importance of preventative care. Steve, I don't know, what do you think? You are in that a little bit more than me.
Yeah, you know, it's a balance. I think there's growing emphasis around prevention, getting a better understanding of identifying issues and treating them sooner. At the same time, there's definitely a push for more individual responsibility. That, you know, people are suffering this health problem because of their own poor choices. And the reality is that's not the case. There are many physical, mental health problems that are related to our DNA, our biology, the environment that we grew up in that we had no choice or no control over. So prevention is very important. We know there's more vaccines. We see less cancers coming in young adults related to HPV vaccines. We see death related to smoking going down. So those are real big wins. But at the same time, we have increased areas where we're pushing off care to say, no, this is something that you have to do. You have to manage your diabetes better. You have to manage your weight better and stuff. Well, it's not as simple as just personal choice. So
I'm seeing a lot more fragmented care, though, too. You know, it's not just you're always going to your pediatrician. It's maybe you're going to an urgent care that doesn't necessarily get the notes back to your pediatrician, or maybe your insurance company says, here, just use this app, and you're somehow getting an exam over an app with some person that who knows where, and they can even prescribe you medicines based on this view. I mean, I think we've all seen the commercial of the worried mom in the middle of the night with a child who has a fever, and she uses the smartphone app and everything gets better. But, you know, that's devoid of a medical home, and, you know, especially in pediatrics, but I think in internal medicine as well, the concept of a medical home is really important, because not every child can take every medication. Not every child has the same exposures. But, you know, if you know that whole child's history and family well, then you're going to help work with the parents to make the best decisions for them versus coming in cold every time. That's partially why some of the reimbursement for emergency visits has to be so high, because with every patient, for the most part, we have to reinvent the wheel and really, you know, is this just a cold or is there some underlying problem here that is previously unrecognized? And I can tell you there has been a lot of times where in the ED, if something was advertised as a simple this, and it turns out once we talk to the family, wow, this is really completely different than as advertised, because we were able to take the time and really go through the details we needed to.
The Affordable Care Act was billed as one that put more emphasis on preventive care. Fair or not, Dr. Cook?
No, absolutely. They put together a separate prevention fund that was funded out of the dollars from the Affordable Care Act to identify that. So there's definitely components of that. The value-based care model works on the medical home of having a system that can be integrated and not fractionated. So you can use technology and apps to help patients to communicate with them better. But, you know, at the same time, we're getting in the effort of having innovative and perhaps entrepreneurship, you know, new ways to deliver care, it breaks up that model. So the Affordable Care Act definitely has a significant emphasis points around prevention, of getting care early, regularly, consistently, of having a medical home, of someone that knows you and knows your health. And data is bearing out in that case as well. There's a recent study in the Journal of American Medical Association showing the patients who had heart attacks were better cared for by their own primary care doctor in the hospital, as opposed to a hospitalist, a doctor who's in the hospital there to care for acutely ill patients, because they knew them, they understood their pain threshold, they understood what was going on with them. So, you know, there's lots of steps in here that the Affordable Care Act is trying to rectify and have more prevention. It's not perfect by any means, but definitely move the needle. And in some places, you're seeing it bend the cost curve, because we're really stepping back and examining where we're spending money and are we spending it well. So the emphasis of prevention is starting to show its head a little bit, and I'm a little concerned that if there are drastic changes made, that that won't be realized, and we'll go back to, you know, kind of ineffective system prior to that.
And you got to remember, you're healthy until you're not, too. That there's plenty of situations where you're taking care of yourself and you're doing all the right things and you're having, you know, all the, you're checking all the boxes with your health care, and then boom, you still are diagnosed with a major disease. You know, I was totally fine until I had my child, and then I became hypertensive. And so here I am, healthy person, fit, good weight, getting, going to my doctor's visits, and boom, now I have this condition, which I am able to manage just fine. But still, I certainly didn't see that coming at 34 years old.
Okay, and when it comes to the way some of our listeners are responding, let me just read Richard's email. He says, "Evan, this sounds like, let me pull this up, sounds like typical alarmist stuff. This sounds like a program that is going to get reauthorized, and in the meantime, it just becomes a political way to attack a party and make them look anti-children." That's from Richard. Richard, look, maybe this will get reauthorized, and I don't think anybody has said the word of the name of a political party today, because it's not supposed to be. And I think everyone in this room who is, especially certainly the guests who are experts on this, have said that it has always been, since CHIP was created in 1997, bipartisan. But to Richard's point, he thinks, well, we're discussing something that will turn out to be nothing because it's going to get reauthorized. So big deal. Steve?
It's going to get reauthorized. I would bet most money on it because, again, it has such a long history of being supported. The problem is they're chipping away at it. They're undermining it. It's something that's good. It works. It's effective. The evidence, the science shows that. And they're calling it into question. And we're calling into question how we should pay for this, as opposed to say, no, this is a staple. And yes, we'll reauthorize it appropriately and for the right amount of time, the right duration.
Okay. What do you say to Richard, Dr. Murray?
So I have been registered as a Republican my entire voting life until this past election. So I've always had kind of different opinions of things as a lot of my colleagues until very recently. I've become very concerned. So I will say that. I agree. I think that it's going to get authorized. But as I said, authorized how? What will it really look like? It needs to be done in a way that's fiscally responsible, of course, but it needs to be done in a way that supports the evidence. And right now we're in a spot where we have the evidence. We have everything you could want in a plan. We have the evidence. There is ways to fund it. And everybody has agreed on it. Again, they just need to take the vote.
Dr. Cook?
For the record, I'm not registered to any political party.
It's the first time I've ever heard doctors talk about their and I didn't even push you for that, Dr. Murray. So now, unfortunately, I have to ask you one follow-up. What specifically? Why in the last year have you changed your registration?
Well, I think because of my job and what I do, it's become more and more evident to me. And I think that, unfortunately, the divisions between the parties have become greater and greater. And that didn't used to exist. I mean, are there policies on both sides that I agree with? Sure. I don't think there is. You know, I'm not extreme on one side or the other. I feel that there's just so much hyperbolic rhetoric in our political system right now that is not helping anybody. And with time, I've changed my views. That's okay. Maybe someday I'll go back. Who knows?
Well, exactly. Who knows? But we've always say it's healthy. By the way, don't take this the wrong way, listeners. I'm not saying it's healthy to go from being a registered Republican to anything else. I'm saying it's healthy to be open to changing your mind in any way. And I admire anyone who's willing to discuss that, because too often obstinance is viewed as the value or, you know, the virtue. But I think there's something healthy in at least being open to evidence. Our guests this hour are talking about CHIP. We're late for our only break. I'll take a phone call when we come back. We've got some more of your emails coming in. And we will talk also about some other issues that they've got on their plate as we head into 2018. Dr. Elizabeth Murray, who's an assistant professor of pediatrics and a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital. And also at Golisano is Dr. Steve Cook, who's an associate professor and a pediatrician there. Talking CHIP and more when we come back with them on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, will the car always be king in cities? Well, a local urbanist says yes. He admits that it will. But some who are not exactly urbanists say that they think there's a war on cars in Rochester, that there's a conspiracy trying to push the automobile out of our city. What does that really mean? What's the future of transportation? What does balanced transportation mean? We'll talk about it. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our first phone call this hour is Jane. First call of 2018, and why not you, Jane? Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. I heard something said that I don't think was meant in the way that it could be heard about patient responsibility, and you're talking about CHIP. And, of course, responsibility doesn't much apply to children because you typically learn your health habits from your parents. You know, you wash your hands really good before you have a meal. You brush your teeth 3 times a day. And if your parents provide you with a lot of junk food, which that happened in my house, my father was a sugarholic, you tend to think that's okay. So you learn a lot from your parents, and it can be positive or it can be negative. So it's totally irrelevant when we're talking about children. They're not responsible, at least not in the earlier years, I would say pre-adolescence. So they don't know. So, and you get sleep. If your parents are up half the night, you may not get the sleep you need. So anyway, I just wanted to, I don't think that it was meant that the children were responsible, but the thing was said about people having to assume more, and that was being more and more encouraged. And I will say this from my own experience. There have been times when it seemed as though someone, the physician, was searching for something that I might have contributed to the problem that I had, the problems that I had. And I'm always saying, they always say, you don't smoke. No, I've never smoked, but I did have a lot of passive smoking. So it's as though they didn't want to believe me that somehow I was doing something that was not good for my lungs in there. So you feel defensive a little bit, like, no, I've never smoked. But the passive smoking, I think, could have effects on children, and they don't have anything to do with that. Thank you very much, Evan.
Yeah, thank you, Jane. Thanks for the phone. Well, that's interesting. So let's talk about this with both of our guests, about the balance of personal responsibility, which, look, I mean, educating people about making good choices about their health is vital, and also genetics and other factors that play in. Because Dr. Cook, I think Jane raised some interesting points. I think she was responding to something you said earlier. So go ahead.
Jane, thank you for your question and letting us clarify. And you're right. Children aren't really responsible in the same sense of their health care as an adult is. As a matter of fact, as a pediatrician, 99% of my patients probably are entirely dependent on someone else to get them to their appointments and get them their medicines and help them take their medicines appropriately. So as a pediatrician, it's not just dealing with one patient, it's dealing with the family, the mom, the whole situation. The personal responsibility piece is kind of twofold. There's a lot of things that we see emerging related to people having to take more accountability for their care, which is appropriate. The balance is blaming all of things on that. And obesity, which is an area I do a lot of research in, is one that has been fraught with this this misperception that obesity is just a matter of personal choice. And that's completely false. There is a growing amount of evidence showing that obesity really is not one disease. It's many phenotypes. There's many factors that contribute to it related to biology, genetics, environmental exposure, medications, and things that impact a child as a fetus, as a young child, that alters their DNA and protein expression. So it may sound like, yeah, you should eat better, but if your biology has been rewired in a certain way because of not great eating habits, how your body has then responded to then holding on calories and maintaining a higher body weight, that's a big biologic driver that personal will can't overcome. So you are correct that children can't really be held responsible in the same way, but we also have to not have this type of personal bias. And we do, as physicians, have implicit and explicit bias with our patients around many health conditions. And we have to work on that. And we actually just authored a paper for the American Academy of Pediatrics. It's the first policy statement on weight bias in children and adolescents. And we know that weight bias experience impacts kids even in daycare level. At that early an age, children are stigmatized and identified because of body appearance and shape and weight. And it impacts them in an educational setting, health setting, many areas. So thank you for your question, Jane, and clarifying that.
And Dr. Murray, what do you think about that balance?
A well child check should never be 20 minutes, but yet here we are where that they are. You know, because there is so much information that a doctor needs to share.
You mean
with
20
a
minutes is not enough?
No way.
Okay.
No way. I mean, because if the child is 2, you're going to be talking about everything to expect for the next year. if you've had a two-year-old, that's different than having a three-year-old. And there's a lot of parenting questions that are going to come up in that year because there's a lot of personality that's going to come out in that two-year-old. And there's new risks and exposures and all sorts of stuff that you need to talk about. But, you know, the focus right now has been on trying to get more patients through so that we can have the reimbursement to maintain the clinics, maintain the facilities so that they can exist with the reimbursement that's offered. And so, you know, we need to have ways to educate our families so that they can care for their children and they can advocate for their children. And yes, part of that, though, is creating children who then go on to be self-sufficient adults and teaching them to be good citizens for their own bodies, citizens in their community, digital citizens, whatever it may be. But a lot of that education can start from these preventative care models of visits with their doctor, teaching the families how to teach their children all of these things. And some of that is going by the wayside when you have a very short period of time. You got to hang your hat on the most critical things for that family at that moment. That might be food and shelter. Forget about all the other fluff things.
Dr. Cook mentioned childhood obesity, a big area of concern and emphasis, especially for you, Steve. What happens to childhood obesity without CHIP?
Well, it's already something that's tremendously unidentified in the clinical setting. I mean, when we've done a national study looking at claims data related to obesity, it was documented in national data sets at less than 0.5% of visits when the national data suggested about 15-16% of kids actually experience obesity. So we as providers have missed it. CHIP is going to impact a lot of things, obesity being just one of them, from the standpoint of trying to connect to a family and get them to the right resources. And not so much because doctors are so effective at doing that during well-child visits. It's because everything else that we're able to do and do pretty well prior to that is going to get pushed back. So our screening, our questionnaires, our identifying other current conditions prior to having the time to talk about, you know, planning family meals and eating right and exercise and watching screen time and, you know, avoiding, you know, sugary drinks and certain things like that. We're going to just try to get the bare minimum through because a family isn't going to have the time or the resources to spend there. It's really going to be something that it's already kind of under-identified. It will really get pushed back just because we're going to try to do the things that we know we have a lot more capability of addressing, like vaccines or asthma control. I mean, we as pediatricians address a lot of things with families. We've been screening for postpartum depression in our practice for almost 15 years. We're screening for a condition of patients that aren't our patients, the mothers. But we know that impacts our patients tremendously, and getting that mother into connected to a provider for mental health care is huge. We were screening for smoking in our parents, in our patients, long before it was fashionable in the state. And we had one of the highest referral rates to the New York State Quit Line for not our patients, the parents of our patients. And we're a pediatric practice because it was something that we had instilled in how we were trained, and we automated it in a system approach that we could do that. We're not going to be able to do any of that stuff now. I mean, we're barely going to be able to triage, you know, which kid is sick and which kid is really sick. That's what it's going to come down to if CHIP isn't reauthorized.
Well, on the subject of personal responsibility or choices, well, I don't know if this next issue falls within that rubric, but let's talk about the fact that Dr. Murray, there's a photograph I have of a slushy machine.
Yes.
Apparently.
Yes.
At an urgent care.
Yes.
Center.
I did not see it with my own eyes, but this was sent to me by a friend, and I believe that this is true. That yes, while at a local urgent care, they noted a slushy machine, two flavors, available in the waiting room.
Cherry and blue raspberry, as
yep.
I see it.
Yes. Yes. And so, my understanding is that is not one of the urgent cares run by either of our local healthcare systems. It's a private facility. But why is something like that happening? I mean, there's no person, I think, that would ever advocate that those are healthy options. And why would that be modeled behavior in a healthcare setting? And that just immediately, to me, calls into the question, what other decisions are being made there if the decision was that this was a good idea to put out to our patients coming in?
You see, it was Brian Regan who joked that when his doctor comes in and he's got one button off for every button. His button-up shirt, his coat is off by a button on each one. He's feeling like, when you stitch me up, I'm not sure how this is going to go. And it's a red flag. So it's a red flag to you to see a slushy machine in an urgent care center.
Yes. Yes. I mean, if you walked into your pediatrician's office and they had that, wouldn't you be shocked and a little horrified?
Yes.
I mean, there's a lot of nice books and maybe a fish tank in your pediatrician's office, and that's fun for the kids to look at. But, you know, we were kind of joking, there used to be a Ronald McDonald statue in the one of our lobbies of the hospital. And I said, well, yeah, but he's not giving out free Big Macs. It's just a statue of the character, because the Ronald McDonald House does a lot of amazing, wonderful work. And in the Ronald McDonald House, they don't give out Big Macs either. So, you know, they make home cooked meals for families. We could do such great work with pediatric urgent cares in the community, and I think some of that is starting to happen, hopefully. But something like that, to me, it seems like a huge step backwards for the care of anyone in our community, not just children.
I hear something that's on Dr. Cook's mind. It's the question of banned words or phrases on the CDC. There's been some controversy about this. Dr. Cook, what's on your mind there?
Well, the concern is that the CDC had been, given direction to have certain terms not part of official documents being prepared for the budget, including terms like fetus, transgender, vulnerability, entitlement, diversity, evidence-based, science-based. To edit such phrases in documents around scientific fact, again, where we're trying to have effective use of our healthcare dollars, in the case of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, trying to do good public health work, and we're going to take out really critical terms in there, or being strongly discouraged not to use those. And I had read a phrase of, instead of using evidence-based or science-based, use evidence-based where available and preferred patient preference or something. And it's like, well, that really flies in the face of evidence, and it's something we're struggling with every day. It's like, yeah, I understand viruses cause a lot of infections, doc, but I just want my antibiotics. You know, it's allowing that individual choice. So then we come back to individual responsibility. Well, yeah, I know I don't have a broken bone, but I want an X-ray anyway, just to feel reassured. You know, that's the same terminology we're applying here. So it's really concerned that one of our major government agencies around health that uses a science base is told not to even use the term evidence based or science based.
What's the alternative for evidence based?
I gotta find the phrase.
It's some long gobbledygook.
It was a long gobbledygook that essentially said, "Yeah, use some science until personal preference kicks in."
I mean, George Carlin would say that's more words with less meaning. We want to use fewer words with more meaning.
Exactly.
So,
or the words we already have. Their meaning is great. Let's just use those words that are on the list. We should just use them because they've been working really well.
Now, the flip side of that is some have said, well, that's based on a couple of sources and some reporting in the Washington Post. But others have said, well, they've heard that it's more from the ground up, that people in the CDC, researchers themselves, are discouraging their colleagues from using those terms, not because they don't want to use those terms or acknowledge those things are real or issues, but because they're worried that federally funding could be cut for things. And it's essentially like, keep your head down, keep you doing your work, because those kinds of areas are going to be under threat the more your head is up and your hand is up for that, which isn't necessarily any better.
Right. I was going
whatever
to say.
Whatever the root of this issue is.
Exactly. What do you want, a hand grenade in one hand and a stick of dynamite in the other? I mean, it's not going to be pretty at the end.
Okay. Last, real quick, I'm going to squeeze in an email from Jillian. She says, can your guests discuss if they know about the Mayo Clinic approach to wellness? From what I've heard, it is a team approach using the view that each person is one organism. And now in the URMC system, it seems compartmentalized, and I go from specialists to one specialist to another, and I'm in no better health, and people don't seem to be talking to each other. Well, that's one person's view, and we hear lots of different viewpoints. That's Jillian. Any thoughts on that, doctors?
Well, I think it's really important to identify that issue and try to go back to your primary care doctor, your medical home, and say, I feel like you're not talking to each other. I will say that being in that system, being in any health system, while Mayo Clinic may have this individualized, personalized approach, I'd like to see it, you know, up front for myself firsthand to get an idea of what it is they're catering to. Because I know that many patients in many situations, when they have chronic conditions and have to go between different subspecialists, that is a common experience. And that's why a medical home is really important, so we can have a good communication system. I will also say that, like Dr. Murray pointed out, the push to still see patients quickly because of fee-for-service is inhibiting our approach as doctors to spend the appropriate time with them, to be able to read through their chart, get a good idea of what's going on, and then go in the room and come in well-informed. That's what we call pajama time. You know, I actually have to go through and review notes of charts of patients the night before to understand what it is they're coming in for. And that's not time I get to take during the day because I'm seeing patients during the day. Or, you know, so it's part of the system that still isn't perfect, and still we're maybe overselling to patients in terms of how much time we're able to devote to them and their care. So I would encourage her to push back to her primary care doc to help get the messages coordinated.
Yeah, 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Remember, the mandate was that everybody had to use an electronic medical record. There was no mandate that they had to communicate with each other. So we are very lucky in Rochester that the major healthcare systems have chosen to be on a system that can communicate with each other. I can look at your records at Rochester General, and Rochester General can look to see what I've done at Strong. And that is great. But every city doesn't have that. And so there's lots of subtleties to this that families, when they become aware, are much more willing to advocate. And I think that this show was good at just highlighting some of those points. And so people need to really pay attention to this. I think something will happen, but is it the right thing? Let's have our voices advocate for the right thing for kids.
Doctors Murray and Cook, I think, are leaving us with an expectation at the end of this hour that one way or another, CHIP's going to get reauthorized. The question is, how long does it go before that agreement happens? How many families could be impacted? Fortunately, New York State's in a little bit better of a cushion than some other states, but what could happen long term? How long will the authorization be? And will some of the funding and the benefits be cut even if CHIP is maintained? So a lot of questions that are still unanswered going forward. And I think Dr. Murray makes a good point. If you keep saying it's going to get done, get it done. You know, then we wouldn't be sitting here today. Dr. Murray, thank you for being here. Always great to have you.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Cook, great having you as well.
Thank you very much.
More Connections coming up.